Excuse me, the recording is now started. Thank you.
Thank you. The point is that the revocation and the delegation are two separate, or the are two separate issues and two separate processes. And the role of the participants changes. For example, if the incumbent manager has agreed to a transfer, he is not necessarily a significantly interested party anymore. He has no special role in the choice of the new one, just like just a role like everybody else. So this is a few technicalities, really. But I think we should be on the same language that we propose to the board, and that the board and the IANA department are supposed to use, so that we know exactly what we're talking about and that there is no misunderstanding.
Eberhard, it's Steve. Again, thank you. It's a great work so far, and I learned a lot from it. The key part that we'll wait before I paste it all up would be the 2.6 on existing accountability measures, and then the language on proposed. And then it'll be essential to share this with our colleagues in the ICG and CWG, since this is one of the four stress tests, which is really about the IANA transition, the IANA functions transition. It's really not about overall ICANN accountability, per se.
And that's why I feel we a little bit of work put in here to get this right is going to go a long way. What is the email address of the stress test working group? Is this accountability 4?
Let me check on that.
Because then I can send this thing through the, to everybody who is connected to this. It has a watermark so that everybody sees it's a draft.
Mm-hmm.
Cheryl, did I hear you?
Oh, yes, you did. I finally got around to getting to me, so, but keep it up. Keep on going.
I see it on the...
Eberhard, I'm going to paste it into the chat for you.
It's already pasted.
Oh, gosh, okay. Three people have done it. So if you could circulate that, folks will see Eberhard's coming up with a very concise, but it's lengthy. It'll make the stress test fill more of a page, and I think it's well worth it. We won't, Eberhard, if it's okay with you, since it's a work in process, I want everybody to see it and understand that you're on the road, but I don't suppose it makes sense for us to go through it until it's complete. Would you agree?
I'm always saying accountability, openness, and so on. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to circulate it as a draft, and it's a PDF, and it has a watermark stating a draft and the day of the draft, so that everybody can read it, so that everybody can provide input, and it's clear that it's not the final product. Yeah. So this is just how I am, how far I got until this morning.
Okay. And then as we, you know, before we leave for Istanbul, and I leave Friday night, I will take Sam's edits. I will take your work in process and all the other comments that I've been taking note of since the last call, and I will circulate a draft version 8 of our stress test application within our working group only. And that way, Eberhard, if more gets to me by Friday morning, 2 days from now, I'll be able to place it all in there. Otherwise, I'll indicate that it's a work in process, if that's all right with you.
I would prefer you call it a work in progress, because I think we need to talk a little bit about the accountability measures, because I have my own specific ideas, but they might not be consensus, able to get a consensus on most of what I want. So it's better we discuss this in Istanbul, set an hour or so specifically for the stress test working party and discuss this so that we come up with consensus language that we can then have a final document by Istanbul that we can then condense into a one-page table, but maybe everybody can read what is the thought processes behind it.
Okay, and Cheryl, this is Steve, but I do think we should discuss on today's call the question of whether we would meet Sunday afternoon if enough of us have arrived in Istanbul in time for the stress test team to get together.
At this stage, it would need to be after where Party 1 and 2 have got their gathering, so it would be an evening thing after the cocktails, as you and I said.
Cheryl, I'm okay with that. I did mention to you on yesterday's chat that 2:30 until 4.
And I did mention to you that my plane doesn't even land till 12:30, and I wouldn't even be probably at the hotel, assuming that the plane landed on time by 2:30. So,
okay.
You know, I mean,
this is breakfast thing. We can do this nicely. Meet at breakfast on Monday morning. Get it done.
The staff, what time do festivities begin in Istanbul on Monday morning?
9 a.m.
Yeah, this time for breakfast, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Cheryl, over to you now that you're on board. We were just reviewing a little bit of what Eberhard had circulated as a draft.
No. I think that's good. Just keep on going. If we have an over breakfast gathering, which I'm more than happy to do, on the Monday, you want to have that an informal, so not a meeting room booked thing. So wherever breakfast is actually being normally served, you just want to gather around a table.
Yeah, just a normal. How many are we in this group? We can get 6 of us together at one table. And whoever wants to provide input can
sure.
come, and then we'll sit together and get it done. I'll have my laptop. We'll get it finalized by the time we discuss it in the main meeting.
Okay, so I'll work on a 7:30 on Monday start arrangement then. Okay, leave that with me, Steve. Get back into the next section if you like.
All right. Made good progress on last week's call, covered a lot of detail. So today we'll begin on page 5 of the document that Alice has loaded in the chat. This is version 7. It has Sam Eisner's edits. This is the same document we were all looking at last week. I have another draft that reflects things that have come in and the notes I took last week, but let's just stick with this draft for now so we can move on, get through it.
Mm-hmm.
So it would be best for people to get onto page 5. So stress tests 3 and 4 are at the top of page 5. Now, on the last call, Sam Eisner was arguing that this becomes 2 stress tests. The 3 and 4 get split, making the argument that litigation was sufficiently distinct from regulations and legislation that it should be separated. And Sam's on the call, so I'll give her a chance to comment on that. Bruce Tonkin had sent us a note that he thought that the community would develop new policies in reaction to, say, litigation or regulation and legislation, and that would be one of the measures that's both under existing and under proposed. And I think that's about all I had on that one. There may not be much more to discuss here, but Sam, if you don't mind, explain why we ought to split this into 2 rather than leave 3 and 4 combined.
I believe I talked a little bit about this last time, but responding to a court order or litigation is different from regulation or legislation. And as I went through, you know, you can see on the page I have multiple comments regarding this section, but it's much different what you need to do to respond to one to the other. Often responding to court orders doesn't necessarily bring into the mixture that there might be criminal liability or personal liability for directors, as opposed to when you're acting in violation of regulations or legislation. The penalties are much different. The legal responses are much different. The abilities to react to them are much different. And so I think it just makes sense to have them as 2 separate stress tests.
Would columns 2 and 3, the existing and proposed, would they end up being different or the same once we split 3 and 4?
Well, I have some fundamental issues with what is in column 2. I mean, so if you look at column 2 as it's written right now, there's really nothing in there that goes to litigation. I mean, I just have some problems with how this is worded in the whole. Responding is saying that new regulations or legislation are equal in acquiescence to government demands, kind of a weird thing to say. I mean, we all follow laws. Are we all acquiescing to government demands on a daily basis? But that's different from how you would respond to litigation, which is different from how you'd respond to court orders arising from litigation. I think that these just need to be separated out and worked through separately.
Any other comments from the folks on the call? All right, Sam, you feel strongly about it, so we'll go ahead and split 3 and 4. But then we're going to need to undertake the work of figuring out what goes in each column. All right, so I think that we ought to move ahead, though, until we get back to that. So I'll split those up in the next draft, and hopefully that'll give everyone a chance to comment on what's on 3 and what's on 4. All right, moving on to number 19, which is on the bottom of here, bottom of page
5.
Okay. So I can't attempt to redelegate a GTLD because the registry operator is in breach. But the registry operator challenges the action. This is in court, not legislation, I guess. And the entity that's charged with root zone maintenance would face the question of whether to follow the redel request or to follow the court order. And this root zone maintenance role is not exactly the same as IANA namings functions coordinator. It's the current role that VeriSign plays. We have discussed this stress test in draft form, I believe, on one CCWG call, because we said that under the current arrangement, NTIA is the contractor to VeriSign. So VeriSign is protected from lawsuits since it's simply publishing the route with a contract with the U.S. government. And the IANA stewardship transition changes that. And therefore, the root zone maintainer might not be under a U.S. government contract. It would not be protected from those U.S.-based lawsuits. And and of course, ICANN is bound to follow appropriate court orders in courts of competent jurisdiction. I believe that came from Sam. That's the comment under existing. So the conclusion we reached was that this is directly related to the transition of IANA and that existing measures might not be adequate. Under proposed measures, we said the community could challenge a management decision and refer things to an independent review panel, but this doesn't protect the root zone maintainer, whoever that is, from any lawsuits. It would simply say that ICANN might have it, the board and management, if they took action in reaction to a lawsuit, those actions could be challenged by the community, and if it was a supermajority, it might even be vetoed if the community had that power. I note in the bottom right-hand corner there that the counterparty that would replace NTIA, remember you've discussed things like contract co and trust, that counterparty is not clear yet. And so we're being deferential here to whatever the CWG's structural separation and recommendations are, since that will help inform this topic. Eberhard, I see your hand up.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
We do.
Okay, I might have to mute. I had a little bit of a coughing fit. One thing is we can protect the root zone operator by holding them free of damages, whatever. My registrar agreement says is that my company is being held free by the registrars of lawsuits that are directed because of actions they take. The other thing is, it's the matter of whether ICANN is bound to follow courts of competent jurisdictions. At the Framework of Interpretation Working Group, we have said, in the end, if you really have want to enforce a judgment from a third country, you have to go to a federal court in America and get a federal court to basically legalize or issue the same judgment, enforce their judgment. As a Californian entity, ICANN is not bound to jurisdiction in third countries per se, unless they fall under this country's jurisdiction. For example, they trade there or they have got assets there. So in Europe, in Brussels, and in Turkey, they would fall under the jurisdictions because courts claim jurisdiction over everybody they can lay their hands on, but the jurisdiction ends at the national border. If ICANN doesn't have assets in the country, doesn't trade there, then it's a matter of whether you can convince a court. If ICANN owns property in the country, it's not a problem.
All right, thanks, Eberhard. And that hold harmless that you spoke of, but that was in the contract between your CCTLD operator and whom?
And our registrars.
Got it.
So if a registrar gets sued, or we get sued because a registrar doesn't pay the invoice for a client over, it's not my problem. The registrar will get stuck with the bill. You understand what I'm saying? One could probably construct it in a way that, because it's a technical function that is operated on contract to another company which doesn't have the technical expertise, for example, one could say, okay, we are the actual originating or responsible party. If you want to sue us, and if you tell the technical partner, if you get sued, we'll cover. We enter the suit as the defendant.
And Eberhard, this is not necessarily a money damages type of lawsuit. NetChoice and the business constituency came up with this stress test last May, and it was designed to surface something hardly anybody ever talks about at ICANN, and that is the role of the root zone maintainer. It's really a technical function. VeriSign has performed it since we began. They don't get paid for it. It's just the publishing function of the authoritative root, which has been picked up by all of the root servers around the world. So an injunction is more than likely what would happen under this scenario. And again, the scenarios are plausible but not necessarily probable, but the notion being that if we were coming up with a singular plural insanity, and we said if ICANN attempted to delegate a singular version of a plural TLD that was already out there, or vice versa, that existing operator, you know, having failed to stop it in the GTLD approval process, might sue to block it from being published globally as a way of stopping what they felt was an unjust intrusion on the zone that they were already managing. And that would be an injunction, I guess, to stop that. Now, if that happens, as Sam indicated in the comment, it may not be possible that the community can do much except to hold ICANN's board and management, hold them to executing the policy that the community had approved. So if the community had approved it and it's about to proceed, then it might be able to weigh in on a board or management decision that was taken as a result of this lawsuit. Sam, I see your hand up. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think we need to get clearer about what it is that we're trying to get through this stress test, because it's really not clear from the text. It's getting a little bit clearer from our conversation, but I'm still not clear about it. So are we looking for protection for the root zone maintainer? I'm not sure, and I don't know if anyone on who's looked at this has verified, but from everything that I understand, there is no immunity that goes to the root zone maintainer today by virtue of the contract, just as ICANN does not have immunity from suit by virtue of the IANA functions contract. So I think that the concept of immunity is something that is a bit of a fiction that I don't know that we should be measuring against. If the issue
That's critical. That's critical here, so we should try to determine that. I was told this by VeriSign.
So if their assigned position is they have immunity from suit, that's fine. I don't know, and I don't know that that's ever been tested in court. The problem is, once we have the U.S. government stepping out, we don't have a possibility of protecting anyone through immunity because a private corporation can't grant immunities to laws, right? Hmm. So the concept of immunity...
Right, but there you have it.
I think that the issue that's being posed still isn't even solved by the immunity concern, right? The issue that's being posed here is, what is a root zone maintainer supposed to do if they receive a verification that says, go ahead and publish the root with this in there, but then there's a competing court order that says, don't publish the root. There's still the issue there, right? And so we're not getting to the right heart of what we're trying to get fixed. If someone could help get a little bit clearer to me on that, are we looking for financial protection? Are we looking for ICANN as a person that develops or as a person that or as a operator that goes through and assesses delegation requests according to policy, as Eberhard suggested, maybe providing an indemnity clause within whatever to a root zone maintainer, so that if the root zone maintainer was ever taken to court for its action in following an ICANN determination on delegation, I mean, that's an easy fix. I don't know if that's what we're trying to get to, though.
Yeah, well, Eberhard, you're next in the queue. But Sam, you're starting to zero in on it. It's about, can the community find a way to hold ICANN management and board to implement the policies that the community has done? And those policies could include the delegation of a GTLD. It's been through years of vetting. It's been through the objections. It's now ready to delegate. The contract's been signed. And then suddenly, something happens exogenously to stop that. The implication here is that under the current arrangement, you probably couldn't stop it, because I was led to understand that Verisign would simply publish it. They don't have to worry about being sued, so they would simply publish exactly what ICANN told them to publish after, you know, of course, it's been certified by NTIA. But in the post-NTIA
calls them to publish, right.
Right, that's right. So under today's arrangement, you can see that there's not any likelihood of interference with that final step of publication. I realize that a given country could suppress it. Go ahead.
It's hard because it's a situation that's never occurred, and I think that the discussion of immunity in this actually masks the issue, right? The whether or not the root zone maintainer today with the U.S. government has immunity or not doesn't change what the stress test is supposed to be about. And so I think that I don't think that immunity and putting in that discussion actually helps anything within this and making it clearer, because the fact that
if the immunity is part of the factor to guarantee that the root zone maintainer simply publishes and would not react to a lawsuit, if that contributes to the ability to get the root published as the community had approved, then it is relevant, because we could potentially lose that immunity under the proposed transition. I think it is relevant. I mean, it might be confusing to bring it in, but it's exactly at the core of what we need to figure out, whether we have some other mechanism, such as you and Eberhard have talked about, indemnification or hold harmless, some other mechanism, then we check the box and we're done. Eberhard?
So I think that part of the issue is that there's an assumption that the court order would always be to block a community developed a delegation that was in line with community developed policy, right? Because there's also the potential that a court order would come in to try to block a delegation that ICANN may have initiated, but that the community didn't feel that it was in line with community developed policy. That's actually right. How I understood your argument on the singles versus plural. And so
go with it then. Go with that one. But this particular one also talks about a breach of its contract. So it could be an ICANN management and compliance initiated an action on the breach of a contract and redelegated a GTLD. So there are several scenarios, community-driven or compliance-driven.
Well, so that's the problem. I'm not sure what we're trying to solve with the way the stress test is written. Can we rewrite the stress test to get to what we need?
Of course we can.
Of course.
I have an issue with injunction from a national court. Courts have got jurisdiction. A national court does not have jurisdiction in the United States. United States courts usually do not have jurisdiction abroad unless there is specific legislation. For example, there is this legislation which says that if an American citizen suffers from a terrorist attack abroad, the foreign country can be held responsible. The foreign countries concerned in a recent lawsuit don't respond to this. In other words, whether a company or an entity in such a country needs to respond to an injunction of a foreign court which has no, where it doesn't have asset, where it cannot be leveraged, is a separate issue. The different thing if the U.S. federal court or a court, if it's a state issue, if the complainant is from the state, gives an injunction, of course they have to abide by it. But if it's a foreign country, I don't see it.
Let's say on the example that it's a U.S. court then, because that's where the RZM VeriSign is based today. So just for the sake of argument, Eberhard, let's assume it's a court that would claim it had jurisdiction over VeriSign.
Wherever the RZM is.
Right.
Courts will enforce their judgments. So if a competent court that has jurisdiction over the root zone maintainer gives a court order to the root zone maintainer will follow this. Will have to and will. There is no question about it.
Well, that is the question. I was told by VeriSign that they would simply publish. They would not pay any attention to a court. I will check on that, and it might be that that clarification will help us understand where this goes from here. This would be the only stress test that focuses on the role of the RZM.
Mm-hmm.
And if we succeed at addressing it, I think it'll help draw some needed attention to the protections for the party that plays that publication role. If we suggest that, this is just too complicated, then we won't be able to address that, and it'll come up sometime later. But sooner or later, I think it will be a concern. Larry Strickling has said that there would be this parallel process. There's the IANA transition, and then in parallel, there's supposed to be a discussion of the RZM. And I don't believe it's happening in the public view. Jonathan?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes.
We do.
Okay, great. Thanks. It's always the first time is always a question. So I guess my thought on this is that we kind of need to focus not on whether or not the RZM would adhere to court order, but what ICANN would then do as a result of that, and would they become engaged in that legal process to enforce their view, et cetera, because in this case, it would likely be that the community would be in favor of the redelegation, even though a court order had been issued to prevent it. Isn't that right?
Yeah, I think that makes sense. That's under the scenario of a redelegation for a breach of contract, that may well be the case.
Right.
And a supermajority of the community...
So you'd have a situation in which ICANN was at odds with, so the question then becomes what ICANN's action would then be. So we know what the RZM would likely do under the, well, or we don't know, but assuming we know what the RZM's reaction would be to an injunction issued by its home legal authority, what would ICANN's reaction to that be, and what could the role in the community be to spur that reaction, whether it's engaging with that national government to get that injunction lifted, for example? So, I mean, that's we're dealing with ICANN accountability, not U.S. government accountability. So the issue is probably what would ICANN do to react to this situation, and what could the community do to influence that reaction?
That's right. That's right. And that's the kind of things that are in the proposed accountability measures column.
Cheryl here, looking at the chat, doesn't that mean that refocusing the problem statement to, as Sam has just mentioned in the chat, focus on ICANN as opposed to the manager would make
right.
it clearer?
Right, and it is ICANN's focus under the proposed accountability measures, which is the key column. It's the key column for these stress
right.
tests.
It's the one that really matters. Right.
It's all that really matters. And it's already written, it's already written that way.
Academic exercise.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And it's already written that way. So it's not refocusing column one as much as what's in column three. But if it helps people to understand it by rephrasing what's in column one, well then they're fine. But it is focused, I mean, Sam, to your point, it is focused on ICANN. That's what the proposed accountability measures column is looking at.
That's right.
Sam, do you want to own, Cheryl, for the record, do you want to own having a go at new language for the problem statement on 19 as a stress test? Great. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks, Sam. And Sam did send over, just as we discussed last week, sent over some really tight text for the compromise of credentials. And Sam, let me thank you for that. I pasted it in the chat earlier, perhaps before you joined, Sam, but send that over to me in an email, and I'll put it in the doc.
Yeah, that's before I joined as well. I had a huge problem getting into the IC room today. Thanks.
Okay. Yeah, so it might be that a hold harmless or indemnification could be there, and I will independently reach out to VeriSign, and I'll ask, hey, what's going on with RZM? Do you guys really have some sort of lawsuit protection? Explain that, because it's being questioned on the stress test call. And I'll do that today.
Right.
Okay, great. Cheryl, okay to move on to the next one?
Absolutely.
Great. Next page, stress test number 20. And this is the one that was driven by the singular plural example, more so than the previous one. Give folks a chance to look at this. And again, the focus is on what is the community's ability, if the community has a near consensus, a supermajority view on ICANN's actions in this case, how can the community assert its strongly held views in a way that reverses or forces ICANN's board to take an action, which is what Jonathan was talking about on the earlier one. That's all we're really focusing on, the community's ability to hold the board accountable for actions it takes in reaction to the stress test, the scenario. So, again, it's a court order similar to the last stress test, but arising under different circumstances. And, again, it's between private parties. ICANN operates under contracts, and there will be differences sometimes about interpretation of a contract when it comes to a breach in the previous stress test. In this case, there could be a court that tries to block a singular version of a plural that's already in the root. Eberhard?
I have a bit of a problem. We live in democratic countries where the rule of law is supreme. If a federal court in California or a California state court, if it's a state complaint, issues a judgment and an order against ICANN, policy doesn't matter. No, the only thing what ICANN can do is litigate this until it's litigated. But policy defers to the rule of law in every country. So I can make whatever policy about what I want. If my Supreme Court in the end decides that this is illegal, unconstitutional, or whatnot, you have to do this. So the question cannot be whether I can be forced to follow court orders reject or not follow court orders, but whether such court orders need to be litigated to the bitter end.
Eberhard, I think that's a great way to say it, and we could phrase it as if the board's only decision is to accept or litigate, that might be the only decision that's subject to challenge. And we could rephrase the stress test in column one so that it reacts to that decision. So the question comes up, under the existing or proposed, does the community have standing and the ability to challenge a board decision to accede to that court order versus to litigate the court order? So under that, why don't you go under that assumption and ask, go ahead.
That would solve my problem, and Samantha is putting her hand up already, so I defer to her because she's the lawyer.
Samantha?
Sorry, coming off mute. Eberhard, please finish what you were saying. My intervention may be a bit different.
I haven't really got. I like what Steve just said. We cannot tell the community cannot tell ICANN, well, if the federal court for the district of what tells you to do this, do something else. We cannot do that. We can say, okay, the board says, okay, they accept the judgment, and the community says, no, you shouldn't. Then we should be able, like Steven said, the community should be able to force the ICANN board to litigate this. In this context, I'm not sure about the consequences. It's a financial consequence if you pursue litigation. There's cost involved and so on. But we cannot tell ICANN to disregard court orders. That's not what this process should look like.
Dan, did that clarify? We're going to rephrase it to say that the management decision is accede or litigate, and if the community had a supermajority that disagreed with ICANN's decision of whether to give in or litigate, what is the mechanism that the community would have to hold ICANN accountable to forcefully execute the community-driven policies? I think that, that really makes it crystal clear, whatever Hart is suggesting, and we can rewrite the stress test to focus on just that decision, since I think that's the only decision.
Yeah, so I understand. I feel that the way that Eberhard has characterized this makes it a lot clearer. It still raises other issues that I don't know if a community directive to accept or litigate is really a workable solution to it. There are issues such as insurance, and ICANN may be in a place that it becomes not insurable if decisions to litigate are made out in a way that's a bit external to ICANN management. I don't know all the details about insurance, mm-hmm. but I know that there could be considerations around that, right? Because insurers, when they come in, expect to have, certain things in place and certain, they would expect to see certain, normal processes in a business and business decisions being taken. and having a community come in and assess a management decision to litigate or not litigate may put that just kind of business reality a little bit at risk. But then there's also the risk of what if there is a determination by the community that ICANN should litigate, but there's no good faith basis to litigate on. That actually subjects ICANN to sanctions in court if it would come out with arguments that are not really good faith arguments.
Got it. So, Sam, if it came up that before the decision was voted on by the community, whatever structure we have, members, delegates, or permit of cost community working group, before the community took the decision to challenge the board's action, presumably we would have this debate openly on the assurance considerations and the good faith requirement. But the community might still, I mean, shareholders can be ornery sometimes, and the community might still say, go for it. And that's exactly what community powers could enable to happen. The considerations you brought up should be brought into effect, but ultimately the board's decisions should be subject to community challenge and overview, and so those consequences could happen.
Yeah, so I agree that a board decision in this way, or if it's board action and acting outside of policy and the repercussions of that, should be subject to community review. I'm not sure that the correct review mechanism is empowering the community to tell ICANN to go litigate, but well, there should be review. This could be one that goes to a spilling the board or something like that.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it should be subject to something very serious, but I don't know that giving the community the power to say ICANN go litigate is really the right place is the right accountability mechanism as opposed to other ones. But it should be
there's no clear accountability mechanism. Right, but I'm unaware of any proposed measure forcing ICANN to litigate. All I've heard are community can challenge or veto a board decision. So if the board, for instance, decided not to litigate, that is a challengeable decision. There's independent review panels as well. So there are not any specific measures about litigate. They're really about measures where the community would challenge a board decision. Eberhard?
As a general observation, I'm a little bit opposed of bringing arguments about costs and this and that when we trying to put in a general rule in here. Specific
right.
and general are two different things. I mentioned when I said that there may be cost implication and others. I don't know the detail. Insurance is one of them. I'm an obstetrician. I have had to stop doing deliveries because my insurance went too much up, not because of me, but because of another country that I'm part of the risk pool with. So I have a bit of an insight. We should look at more implications our decision has, but we should not say, okay, we leave that because it may have implication. So I'm grateful for Samantha to bring this up. But we should not be deterred by considerations that are more on a lower level than the community accountability that NTIA expects from us.
Sam, I think your hand's up, but I think Jonathan as well. Go ahead, Sam.
Just on that. On the insurance issue, Eberhard, I was not raising it actually as a cost issue. How litigation is paid for is one thing, but it's actually about an insurability issue, which goes to the health of the organization, which has a whole trickle-down effect. It's not about the cost of the litigation. It's about the insurability and the business integrity from the business operational side of the organization that I was concerned about.
And Sam, you're hearing from a lot of the rest of us.
I'm not saying that. That's not the point. The point is not a cost issue. I didn't want it to be understood that way. But I'm saying the cost and insurability, and these are secondary issues that influence the global issue that we are dealing with. So it is good that we know what the consequences of our proposals are, But we should not say, okay, because there is now at business issues that prevent us from having accountability measures. Yeah, if I, to sort of globalize this from the specific more to the global, cost is not necessarily the issue. Insurability is an issue, but I think we should look at it more like what consequences our decisions may have and take them into consideration, but not say, okay, because that will affect the way we do our business, we can't have that mechanism. Not that I'm saying that's what you're saying. We should keep this in mind while we're discussing this.
Jonathan?
Yeah, I guess what's interesting about this discussion is that it's easy to lose the forest for the trees, in that what we're really looking at here is this particular stress test covered by the proposed accountability measures, or does this stress test call for additional accountability measure that we've not yet thought of? And that's the interesting thing. I mean, the actual accountability measure itself is very generic, which is, you know, the ability of the community to overrule the board. What Sam may be pointing to is an additional question that needs to go to the CCWG legal consultant as to whether or not there need to be any limits on that accountability mechanism, in particular conditions that would affect insurability, and those may need to be discussions that have to be had, that it's not actually a question of whether this stress test requires a different accountability mechanism, but it may be a question about whether or not this is a place where limits need to be placed on a particular accountability measure or a context in which limitations need to be. So that's the question that it feels like has actually risen to the top in this discussion is a question for our legal consultants. I mean, the actual discussion about whether or not to go forward in litigation, all of these things would come to the surface, and I think, you know, whether or not it's a whether or not there's a just cause for litigation, et cetera, would be subject to interpretation. And I think we are willing to say that the community as a whole needs to be able to do that. But I mean, there may be a question about whether or not a limit needs to get placed on this. So that's a question that we need to set aside. It's outside of this specific exercise, which is. Are there going to be exception instances for the accountability measures that we propose? So we need to set this aside as a question for the legal team.
All right, so we're going to rephrase this to be, the question is, how does ICANN's board respond
That's
to
right.
this court order? And the chair says, or litigator follow it? And does the community, under the existing and proposed, what is the community's standing? And the tools available to the community to challenge or reverse that decision. And all the considerations that have been brought up about insurance and good faith, those are part of the conversation the community would have before it made a decision to override the board's decision. Great. All right, good discussion. Ready for the next one? Any further items on this? Okay. Next stress test is number 10. Give you guys a chance to read that. It's on the next page. It's actually a combination of number 10 and number 24. Malcolm Hutchie added number 24, and you can see some of the language that Malcolm uses, the sui generis entity. And he talks a little bit about the mission and scope creep. The comparison between existing and proposed really looks at the fact that today NTIA, with its control of the IANA functions contract, has an ability to discipline ICANN and keep it within its limited technical mission, since it could withhold the IANA contract if it felt ICANN had expanded too broadly. And the community does have input on things like the strat plan and budgeting, but it's not definitive and it cannot challenge the strat plan and budget. It cannot challenge decisions that were made. Sam had added under the, since we have discussed this before, Sam had added that the California Attorney General has jurisdiction over nonprofit entities. So that certainly is an existing mechanism. Under the proposed, we talked about some of the standard things we've covered before, this notion that the community could veto a budget, overturn a board decision if it were something that the board voted on, empower the community to challenge a board decision to an IRP. Of course, the standard of review is the key there. And then finally, in the lower right-hand corner of the proposed box, another measure is the prescriptive restriction on ICANN's activities. Those of you who were on last night's CCWG call, when Becky Burr was discussing Work Party 2, that is one of the items that they're trying to design, is a golden bylaw, I believe they call it, to prevent expansion of scope beyond what's needed to protect the operation integrity of the DNS and unique identifiers. So if that were there, it's a fourth mechanism that would be able to prevent this. And all these would replace the sort of soft discipline that NTIA holds over ICANN today through the IANA contract. So we'll take a cue on this one. Yeah, so maybe this isn't such a controversial stress test. It's pretty clear that we're focusing tightly on what the community can do to either proscribe or remedy it if ICANN acted to expand its mission. Cheryl, unless you have a...
Moving on.
Anything to add? That's great. So I think this one passes the sniff test. Let's go to number 12 on the same page. I think that Eric Bruder-Williams had added this stress test. It's called Capture by One or Several Groups. This is a tough one because so much of what we're proposing has to do with supermajority, which is not something that's subject to capture. There is one stress test we have focused on, which is the notion of the GAC changing to majority voting. And if it did so, GAC advice carries with it the obligation of working out a mutually agreeable solution. And that's part of our bylaws. So there's a discussion on, I believe, the stress test 18, where we say that ICANN should change its bylaws so that only consensus advice carries that high, high bar of working out a mutually agreeable decision with the GAC. So we focus this one mostly on the only place that capture could potentially come from, which is the GAC. And it ends up being the kind of capture that a lot of this transition is discussing. One of the conditions of the transition imposed by NTIA was that ICANN, it would not transition in such a way that the functions currently maintained by NTIA could be assumed by government or intergovernmental entities. Sam, you're in the queue. Go ahead.
So one of the... When I read the stress test of capture by one or several groups of stakeholders and, you know, watching some of the discussion around the hearing in Washington, and, you know, I read this as a lot more of a broad statement that one of the key stress tests that we need to come out of is that any new structures that we create help protect against any group, not just the GAC, acting with undue influence in the system. That we need to try to build in protections or at least look over every single structure that's coming out to see how we can protect against undue influence being exercised by any single group. Sure, we have a specific issue as it relates to policy set out right now with that's been expressed as it relates to the GAC and a two-thirds bylaw, or the two-thirds vote and consensus, and of course the two-thirds vote for the board is off the table, but the consensus, the supermajority issue, but that really is just a very small part of it. I think we need to look a little bit more holistically about capture or undue influence being exerted in, at any place across the board. So this would go to, as we're developing, we were talking yesterday on the CCWG call about a potential, standing cross-community working group. What protections are we building into that to make sure that no single group or entity can influence across the different stakeholder groups that are represented there to make sure that ICANN does not become a vehicle for any single entity or collection of interests to actually determine the will of the organization. I think this is more broad.
Right, and Sam, I don't know what to say. I mean, read what it says in the upper right-hand corner of this box. It's about the broad issue of supermajority as being, we're suggesting the supermajority requirement is effective prevention of capture by one or a few groups. So it might be that we haven't defined whether it's two-thirds, three-quarters, or four-fifths. We don't know yet because the CCWG hasn't come up with its proposal. But it's possible also to add the question of what is a quorum? What if four of the 11 ACSO and SG simply abstain from a decision, leaving only seven, and five of seven decide to vote for it? Could those five represent a supermajority in that case, and would they have the ability to capture the community's point of view? I mean, it's possible, but we are dealing with the general case. That's the primary part of the stress test, is by requiring supermajority. Did we miss that? And go ahead, Teresa.
Hi. So thanks, Steve. I think one of the aspects, I hear where you're coming from with regards to the proposed accountability measures on that, but I don't think that actually solves for the broader question of how does one ensure that there isn't capture overall within the structure or any new things that are being created. What are the mechanisms, in the SOACs, what are the mechanisms of responsibility and accountability and prevention of capture across the structures within the organizations, as well as looking at, obviously, the question in the context of the GAC. Governments have come up in several contexts. But I think the broader question is, to the point 12, capture by one or several groups of stakeholders across the entire structure of the organization and what mechanisms are in place, do those need to be checked or strengthened in any way? Because that's all part of it, right? Even if you have a community empowerment mechanism of any sort, that community empowerment mechanism has to be assured that it isn't prone to capture in any way. So I think there's a broader issue here, and I'm not sure how to phrase it, but there is a broader issue that has certainly come up in all the discussions that you and I and everybody else have been hearing.
Teresa, you're right. So let's do two things. We'll add to the right-hand box that in addition to supermajority, a question of what constitutes an adequate quorum, and within each ACSO and SG that comprise the community, we have to examine the requirements for transparency and accountability to ensure that capture doesn't occur within those groups. Do I have that right?
Yeah, I think that's a start to what needs to be looked at from a holistic standpoint.
We say holistic, but we're going down into the underlying communities to see whether those communities themselves have accountability and transparency and measures that prevent capture by some party that's external to them. Because if the ALAC is captured by at-large users, that's not capture. It's only a question of whether some other group, let's say the registries, have begun to exert influence in other non-registry ACSOs and SGs. that would be what you're looking for protection against.
Well, I think you're looking for protection against capture by one or several groups of stakeholders. And by holistic, I mean across the organization, right? So you want to ensure that you have the checks and balances mechanisms in place across the structure, and then especially if you're looking at, discussions around community empowerment mechanisms, there has to be accountability and prevention of capture within those community structures as well, right? And so what are the tools and mechanisms to ensure that there isn't any possibility of capture, and that there's tools and mechanisms for transparency, accountability, and responsibilities, and clarity around that, so that if there were a situation of capture, it would become immediately apparent.
Okay. And so I think I proposed adding that to the text in the right-hand box as something we would want to evaluate when the proposals come back, but there's benefits to surfacing this while we're all together in Istanbul, so that Work Party 1 and Work Party 2 that are developing mechanisms to empower the community be conscious of the need for transparency and accountability to prevent capture across ACSO and SGs. So I think I've got that right. Sam?
Steve, I think that how you just summed it up was where I was going to, that this is really about testing each of the accountability measures. This one's a little bit different from the other stress tests that we're discussing, because the other stress tests that we're discussing go to specific issues and do accountability measures get to those. This is something that has to be really applied. First, there can be places where we identify, as we have, for some accountability measures to protect against it, but also this is one that needs to be overlaid over every structure and every new measure that we're coming up with through the CCWG. It's that double-edged sword there.
It's sort of a meta requirement, isn't it?
Exactly.
Yep.
Okay. All right. It applies as well to the CWG, to the extent that there are mechanisms in the CWG for naming numbers or protocols. It's possible that the groups that would exercise the replacement of NTIA's role would have to have the same examination.
Yes, indeed.
Without a doubt. That's one of the purposes of the NTIA's criteria.
Right, and Sam, I do think that we are supposed to apply our stress tests to all proposed solutions once the proposed solutions come back. But you're right, this one has a particular significance in that it covers all of these community empowerment items. Any other discussion on number 12? Okay, seeing none, let's go to the next one. Number 13. Is somewhat related. It's a meta application of tests because we are concerned that, if you recall in Frankfurt, we talked about empowering the community, but by increasing the accessibility and affordability of review and redress mechanisms, such as the IRP or reconsideration. And yet, if we make them more accessible and affordable to the community, I guess they're more accessible and affordable to individuals too, aggrieved individuals. And so the stress tests ask the tough question, how do we prevent the purposeful paralysis of ICANN through the use of review and redress mechanisms that we're designing? This is going to be a challenge. With respect to existing and proposed measures, the conclusions here are that we don't think we have this right. And it may be that the existing measures that we have today, because they make it so hard and expensive to file an IRP, that it's it's still done, but it isn't perhaps at the scope it would be if we made it so much more affordable and accessible. Now, under the proposed measures, we did say that when the community had standing to make those measures more accessible, that the community itself was only able to do so through a supermajority, that we could add to this one the same discussion of quorum, accountability, and transparency within the groups that we just discussed in the previous stress test. That way that if the community were given special standing and access to an IRP or reconsideration, that the community could act, but individuals might not. And I'm not close enough to what Work Party 2 has been discussing. Anybody on the call that can help us on this, is Work Party 2 considering making IRP and reconsideration more accessible to individuals or only to this so-called community action? Eberhard?
I don't know what they're doing, but as far as CCTLDs is concerned, there must be redress for individuals. You cannot have the community decide whether a CCTLD can redress anything.
And Eberhard, is that the same under existing as well as proposed?
Existing, there is no existing mechanisms at the moment for CCTLD.
So under the existing column, I should say there is no present mechanism for a single CCTLD operator to achieve review and redress of decisions.
If a CCTLD is revoked and transferred, that's it. There's nothing you can do so far, or nothing that you can afford to do so far. Big CCTLD would, has, of course, the financial resources to have this then adjudicated in court, but small CCTLDs, and that's what basically was happened, just get driven over by the big truck and go by the wayside.
Mm-hmm. Could if it had new powers that you just described, could a single CCTLD operator with the power to challenge, could it actually paralyze ICANN's policymaking and operations by using that challenge? It's not obvious to me.
No, you just asked whether the redress mechanism should be restricted to the community and not to an individual, and I said I think we cannot restrict it only to the community and not to an individual.
Mm-hmm.
Because that will take any redress a CCTLD manager might be able to have out of the equation.
Now I understand your reaction, and so I probably set you down on the wrong path. What I was suggesting is that one of the things we decided that we wanted to do when we were in Frankfurt was to make IRP and reconsideration more accessible and give the community standing, so make them accessible and affordable, and make the community allowed to file a reconsideration and an IRP and not have to come up with $1 million to do an IRP, because the community itself doesn't have a bank account. What I said earlier is that it's possible that those affordability and accessibility improvements, it's possible that they would open the door for individuals to paralyze ICANN. So the question became, should the affordability and accessibility improvements be restricted to the community? And if they were, individuals would still have the exact same powers they have today, whether a CCTLD or an individually aggrieved party. So I don't think there's any attempt to reduce what individuals can do. There's a question of whether individuals get empowered to the point where they could paralyze ICANN. Does that make more sense?
It makes more sense, but individuals in the CC sphere will not be able to paralyze ICANN because an individual can only deal with one CCTLD, since an individual is only the CCTLD manager that has impact. He can sort of litigate it to the end and be done. But it's not that, for example, I can go and the last 10 redelegations or revocations we had, and I now as a CCTLD manager or maybe even an unaffected third party start redress procedures against each and every one and go and take it to the end. That's not the point. Yeah, but we should sort of find a way to avoid paralysis, but we should not at the same time sort of kill two birds with one stone and have unintentional consequences.
Okay. Agree completely, and yet nothing in this discussion would remove the current capabilities for a CCDL operator. If you're suggesting
There is none.
Understood.
We are adding some, but we don't. And now we are asking the ones that we're adding: will we add them? To what level will we add them? We need to add some, but I fully agree we must limit that to the extent that it cannot paralyze. But at the moment, a CCTLD operator has no recourse whatsoever if he cannot afford legal fees, billable hours.
Okay. Understood. And we have a separate stress test, the one you just contributed a lot of work in progress on, about giving more power to challenge a revocation decision, and I get that. This particular stress test asks a different question. What if we've increased the accessibility of community review and redress to the point where an entity could paralyze ICANN's policymaking? So it's not likely to be the case that the improvements we recommend as a result of the CCTLD stress test would put us at risk of the stress test. I'm not seeing the connection there, and I may have gotten us off on this unnecessarily, but I don't see the connection here. We're just talking about paralysis of ICANN, and the key paragraph is in the lower right-hand corner, which is that some CCWG proposals may make redress more accessible and affordable, and that would increase the ability to block. So we're really suggesting here that this stress test identifies a risk. Remember that we just covered in the last one the risk of capture? Well, the risk of paralysis is very parallel to that. And so it's both an advice to those of us who are designing things in the CCWG, but it also says that the stress test team is going to take a look at that. That let's suppose Work Party 2 came back with the ability to drop the cost of independent reviews for anyone, for any aggrieved party, to drop the cost of the accessibility, and we would look at that and say, hang on, this adds to the risk of stress test number 13, and it might need ability to be remedied. And the remedy to that isn't to stop an individual from filing anything or to reduce their capabilities from what they have today. The remedy to that could be that the improved accessibility and affordability were only available to the community at large. Any further comments on that?
As convoluted as you make it sound, the point, if I condense this down, is that currently a CCTLD manager has no recourse. Now, we're implementing some accountability measures, but we will, in the end, prevent individual CCTLD managers from using them, because they can use what they have now, which, as I said repeatedly, is zero.
And Eberhard, do you believe that we're going to address that in the stress test that you're working on now?
I am contributing to the discussion that you have been starting on stress test 13, where you said individuals can use what they have now, and as a hypothetical, I'm not saying, don't get me wrong, but we're basically, you stated that individuals can do what they have now, but communities can get more. And I'm a little bit concerned there, and that's why I bring this up.
Okay. What would you propose we do to take note of that concern on this stress test?
I haven't really thought about it that much, because I'm busy. We are not, as I just saw on the chat, we're not really strapped for time, because it hasn't been resolved on Work Party 2, so we can continue thinking about this.
Okay.
But
to put a placeholder there,
we must under no circumstances under the guise of increasing accountability, accessibility, not increase the accessibility of individuals who are in fact aggrieved. I fully agree we shouldn't increase the accessibility to individuals to an extent with some complaints will file complaints just for the filing purposes and for the satisfaction they get from it. But I'm really concerned about the small CCTLD managers that have been railroaded and that are busy getting railroaded. And I want to be able that those individuals, smaller CCTLD managers, get as good as accessibility and for accountability measures as possible.
Okay, so I'm going to note in the existing column that there is no present mechanism for a single CCTLD operator to challenge a revocation. And then in the proposed measure, I'll say that CCWG may need to increase the accessibility and affordability for an individual CCTLD operator to challenge a revocation. How does that sound?
My point is not to write what individual CCTLD managers have. What I don't want is that we say we increase this for the community, but individuals can't challenge to prevent individuals from overdoing it. Yeah. So I don't really want if an individual is affected by the decision, the individual must whether it's CC, ALEC, GATLD, doesn't matter. If an individual is affected by a decision, that individual must have recourse. If currently the individual has no recourse, you must increase that. We must
I think that's exactly what I just said, that we would take a note in this stress test. Go ahead, Cheryl.
I just wanted to pick up, Jonathan has his hand up, and seeing as he's part of Work Party 2, he may have something to help focus us on future time when we'll be discussing this in greater detail.
Yeah, go ahead, Jonathan.
Thanks, Cheryl. I guess I was going to say is that this conversation about greater accessibility is definitely a heated one within Work Party 2, and so that and about affordability, and there is an awareness of the risks associated with the over accessibility, if you will, of these accountability mechanisms, what the implications of that might be. So that's probably the place for the conversation about what should go into the framework. We're not coming up with the framework here. We're looking at example stress test evaluations based on a hypothetical framework in this particular work group right now. So I mean, I think Eberhard, this isn't the place or the group of people right now that are trying to figure out what these accountability measures are going to be, but just trying to figure out if we've gone through a sufficient stress test exercise and this hypothetical exercises of comparing these stress tests, using these stress tests to measure against the accountability mechanism. So I think it is a hotly discussed topic right now, and it'll be part of that conversation that's happening in Istanbul, and it is on the list as well about how to increase accessibility without increasing noise. In that particular accountability mechanism, but it's not our this group isn't the one making decisions about what accountability mechanisms should be put in place.
Thanks, Jonathan. Did you want to very briefly respond to that, Eberhard?
It's not our place, but it is our place to decide what stress test we put in.
Sure, and I think we can all concede that making an accountability mechanism that was previously infrequently used due to cost cheaper will increase the frequency, could potentially increase the frequency with which that accountability mechanism is used, and that could, in a sense, create its own stress test. So that's really just the issue, but how we address that risk is another conversation. So I think all we're establishing here is that possibility, is that risk potentially increased by increasing the accessibility of this particular accountability mechanism. And I think we can all agree that that risk increases. Now, we might all agree that that's okay and it's worth it, right? But, I mean, the question is, does that risk exist? And I think we can all agree it does.
Yeah.
Jonathan, I might also suggest that if we gave increased powers for a single CCTLD operator to challenge a revocation, that's unlikely to rise to the level of paralyzing ICANN. So it's possible that Eberhardt's concern would never even have entered the stress test.
That's right, too. I would agree.
Okay. All right, let's... any other discussion on this one? I'm going to add the quorum and accountability transparency requirements to prevent capture. I'm going to add that to the right-hand box.
Yep.
And take note of the fact that if we give individuals new powers as a result of this transition, those new powers themselves can be stress-tested for paralysis, but we shouldn't rule out the ability of enhancing individual redress. Not at all. And Eberhardt's example is a good one. Okay, let's move to the next one. It's number 16. We discussed this pretty extensively in Singapore. So, Cheryl, it's possible this one doesn't need further discussion. What are your thoughts on that? This is number 16.
Yeah, look, I wouldn't mind this particular group having a quick run through, mainly because part of our exercise with this run through, which is, again, preemptive, which we all understand until all the other mechanisms are in our possession. But what we're also trying to do is change the status of each of these stress tests in our running tally of where we are. And I'd like to see everything certainly to a second, if not third, read before we get too much further into drafting for public comment work. That's all. So a brief run through just to make sure the I's are dotted, the T's are crossed. And, of course, we do have Sam's comment, which was a post-Singapore one.
And with respect to Sam's comment, I mean, Sam, the community has no standing. It could not have challenged board decision to create NetMundial. So you wrote here that any of the appropriate mechanisms could have been initiated. Well, yes, but not by the community, and that's our point. So this is why the existing measures are inadequate. The community had no standing. Only individuals and aggrieved parties had standing.
That's fine, but it's not based on the secret nature of the resolution. It's based on the status.
I understand.
Yeah.
Exactly. So if it helps, I can break that paragraph into two, but I didn't say that it was the secret part, but there's no way for the community to challenge and reverse the decision. I don't think that statement's at issue here. Any other discussion on this one? Okay, hearing none, Cheryl, if we jump to the next one, this has been discussed on two of our CCWG calls. This is stress test number 18, the infamous consensus.
It's not. Stress test. Don't call it infamous yet.
No, it's a good one. It's a really good one. I especially like it because it gets straight to the heart of U.S. government's requirement that we not transition in a way that increases the likelihood that governments or intergovernmental bodies could capture ICANN decision-making. So I believe this one has been through the ringer a few times. May not need too much further discussion by this group.
Probably not too much further,
no. And the GAC answer, I mean, I shouldn't say the GAC answer, sorry. The GAC chair wrote back to the chairs of our CCWG but the answer was completely non-responsive to the proposed bylaws change that we were evaluating in the stress test. Because our bylaws change is only with respect to what ICANN must do when it gets GAC advice, and it constrains the requirement for coming up with a mutually agreeable solution, mutually acceptable solution, to only those instances where the GAC advice was supported by a consensus of the GAC. So that leaves the GAC free to change its rules, and it might do majority voting, and sometimes it might send advice over that is consensus, and sometimes it might not be. But it just says that on the ICANN side, the obligation of a mutually acceptable solution is only there when it's consensus. So I hope we keep this one alive and stand firm on this one. This is a vital improvement as a result of the transition. I don't think it's directly related to the transition, except to the extent that the U.S. government placed a condition that we guard against the stress.
Certainly from the conversation at the most recent CCWG call, I see no evidence that would suggest we do other than run this stress test as she is writ. There's certainly no downside to running it.
Agreed. And Alice posted the Thomas's letter, which we don't want to call a GAC letter because it wasn't even presented as a GAC consensus.
And we also should note that in the most recent call as well, and we probably need to update the discussed on dates there when you're doing the next draft, Steve, just capture that so we get the most recent call, which was my time yesterday. There was other GAC members saying that certainly their local interests would be, or individually or in some small group, be putting other advice. I don't know whether that advice would be in any way different, but there will be other materials coming in. And regardless of all of that, the stress test as it is writ still, I believe, should stand. And unless anyone on today's call can argue very strongly against that, I think that's just how we run stress test 18.
Good. Finn Peterson, a GAC member, looks to be typing something in the chat. Finn, should we wait for you to finish that?
Please.
Oh, great.
Look, he has. Just for the record, Finn notes the stress test seems reasonable. And obviously, further dialogue is needed with the GAC. Absolutely. And this is not unrelated to going back to Teresa's earlier point, of course, of looking with greater granularity at the accountability and transparency aspects of all of the component parts to what we call community in ICANN.
Right, and the dialogue with the GAC is potentially just continuing to explain this does nothing to impair the GAC's policy decision-making. I mean, I want to encourage the chairs of the CCWG not to bail out on the stress test because certain members of the GAC either misunderstand it or don't agree with it. It's essential that we cover this risk in order to get the transition done.
And as we've said a number of times, it doesn't have to be probable. It just has to be possible to be a stress test.
Okay, we have five more to go. So, number 22. Create some optimism here. See if we can get this done in the 20 minutes. 22 is the next one, and this was discussed in Singapore when we were all together. Give you folks a chance to read it. Four measures under proposed are still alive today. I think that work party 2 and 1 continue to look at allowing substantive matters to be challenged in a reconsideration, so it's not just a process. The notion of forcing an ATR-T&D recommendation implementation, independent review panel, and there's a question as to whether the IRP decisions would be binding or not. And even if the case where they were binding, if the ICANN board did not implement a binding IRP decision, I guess the ultimate is in the lower right-hand corner, which is to spill the board. Cheryl, let you manage it. Any queue on this one, or have we sufficiently exhausted number 22?
Hopefully there won't be any queue on this one, Steve.
All right.
And nobody's looking like they're typing even, so let's move.
Good. 23, which I don't believe we've had a substantive discussion on this group yet. Okay.
Yeah.
This is getting to the limited mission. And this came from Malcolm Hutty. And the stress test would be going outside the scope of ICANN's mission, not through something like a net mundial, we covered that earlier, or brand new initiatives, we covered that earlier, but rather the use of ICANN's contracting authority to start to impose requirements on third parties, which is what contracts are all about, outside of the mission. And when I asked Malcolm about the third parties involved, he said, well, you know, registrants and end users. And today, registrants and users have no standing to challenge ICANN on its approved policies or the implementation of a policy, and that the proposed measures would help only to the extent that registrants and users are part of ACSOs and SG, the ALAC for at-large registrants and users. In the business constituency and the IPC, a lot of registrant and user interests in there. Mm-hmm. And I would suggest to you that the GAC considers itself representing the citizens of each respective country, and those citizens are both end users and registrants.
Mm-hmm.
So there's quite a bit of attention given to giving affected third parties who aren't actually contract parties the voice to challenge something if they can muster a supermajority of the so-called community. Sam, you have three comments on this one, so I'm going to give you a chance to walk us through what you think those comments would do to change the text of the stress test.
Well, this is another stress test where I think we need some more clarity. I've highlighted within the stress test itself that I'm not really clear what that sentence means that I highlighted in there, the contracted parties not being implicated by the requirements themselves do not avail themselves as mechanisms. I don't really understand what that's trying to say. I think we need
I could translate for Malcolm. Malcolm suggested that, let's say, registrars, in the case of the registrars themselves are simply passing along some requirement to the underlying registrants, so the registrars themselves aren't affected to the point where they're going to challenge ICANN's decision on a new policy, but it's the registrants that have to bear the brunt of a policy. Suppose it's a licensing requirement for registrants and doctor. There may be registrants that object to that, but they wouldn't have help from the registrar to challenge that. So I think he's saying that the parties who can challenge, the contract party itself, if it passes through to registrants, it may not care. It may not challenge. I think that's a fair reading of what he said.
Yeah, I think we benefit by having the language in here a little bit clearer because that makes it a little bit easier to respond to. I guess that there's an issue of, are we talking policy or policy? You know, are we talking registration policies that may be forced through a contract versus implementing ICANN policies? So I think we need to be clear about that, too, because some of my comments here go to the policy development process as opposed to registration policies that aren't necessarily ICANN, you know, the developed through ICANN policy development processes.
Do you have the specific changes you propose to clarify that?
I can come up with some. I guess I feel like we're talking about two kinds of policies here, right? We're talking about, you know, approved policies that come through the PDP process where, you know, affected third parties actually have the ability to participate in the policy development process itself. And so some of the wording around challenge, et cetera, doesn't quite make sense versus registration policies that come through a contract that don't hit the PDP level, right? They're registration requirements, for a better word, as opposed to policies. I think we need to separate the words that we're using. That makes it a little bit clearer what we're trying to get to.
We should put both then. So it's both the development through the PDPs and the implementation of contract requirements. I think we're talking about both.
Yeah, agreed.
Okay, so if I put the word both in there, then people will understand that we're covering both, and I'll put that into the stress test call.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm going to read this one very critically because of the consequences there, and so I will keep reading it very critically as we iterate through it, because any suggestion, this isn't just about ICANN, this is about the contracted parties as well, any suggestion that it's being used to leverage market power is a really serious suggestion that we have to look at carefully. It's not, and this is not just an issue about protecting ICANN. This is an issue about all the contracted parties as well, because any of them who are seen as quote-unquote acquiescing or just not caring about what's in their contract is a way to leverage their market power. That's a really serious thing. And so I don't and it's hard for me. Well, I understand how this consequence flows from this, but I don't know if that's if that's the only consequence, because one of the other consequences seems to be that there's a group of people who feel like they have no ability to affect how contracts are put in place at ICANN. It's not even a market power issue. It's about just the general issue. So I think that there might be two consequences there.
I don't think the way Malcolm wrote this, I don't believe it had anything to do with the contract parties exerting market power. It's the non-contract parties that are affected and what redress powers that they have.
Right.
So
but
I'd rather not get into the market power issue.
Yeah. So anytime that there's the ability for ICANN to leverage power in a market, you have to think about the fact that that actually has a complementary aspect. You can't just separate out, this is only about ICANN, because if the words are about contracted parties just passing through things and not acting along with ICANN, that's a market power issue too. Just because the words don't focus on it doesn't mean that in the legal reality it poses really big risk for contracted parties as well as ICANN. So we just have to really be aware of that as we're writing it.
So help me out. The words really be aware of that. I get that. But where do we put that in this stress test?
Well, I think it goes with a bit of a rewriting of the stress test itself.
And as you do so, don't lose what Malcolm, please.
Oh, no. It's about the clarification. I'm not suggesting that we take out the issue that he's raised. I'm saying we need to be really clear about what we're talking about when we're raising the issue.
I'm not getting it.
Because of the severity of the risk to everyone in the system.
I think we all hear
that,
and understand that.
I'm happy to wait for the, yeah, go
yeah.
ahead.
I think we all hear and understand that, Sam. I also think that I guess you've got another piece of text to do while you're on a while you're on a roll.
Yeah. Yeah. And then within the second column, you know, as we start looking at this between the ICANN policy development process and the approved registration policy or the approved mm-hmm. registration requirements, there's a little bit of difference there, right? So there's the first existing accountability measure says affected third parties have no standing to challenge ICANN on its approved policy. Well, the actual accountability measure that's there is the PDP process itself, that they have the opportunity to participate, and that's on the PDP side.
Well, I'll add that. I'll add that.
There's also a public comment requirements that go along with changes mm-hmm. to contracts. So that's another place for influence, though it doesn't go to challenge, clearly, but it's a place to influence what actually comes into a contract itself.
I'll add that. Yep. Anyone can participate in a PDP, and anyone can participate in a public comment period on things like contract changes. I get that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah, got it.
And then we've discussed before on I don't know if it was on this call or a CCWG call, but ICANN changing its legal jurisdiction doesn't necessarily have a direct effect on where people can sue ICANN. So this is stated in a much more I'll think about it. Maybe recommend a little bit of language to flesh it out, but this isn't
mm-hmm. Right, but Sam, it doesn't say changes its legal jurisdiction that would affect. It said could affect and used the word
right.
necessarily, and I understand that, and that's why it's worded as could but not would. Does this need to change further?
I need to think about that one.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, so I'll definitely make the change to identify PDP and implementation of registration requirements. That'll be in column one. Column two, I will add that anyone can participate in a PDP and anyone can participate in a public comment period. But so far, those are the only
and
two
And that
changes.
There are public comment periods on contract changes.
That's right.
Okay.
I'll put that in as well.
All right.
Okay.
Next.
Next is number 14. This was discussed in Singapore, so it might be quick. Remember the affirmation of commitments, this notion that it could be terminated. And because of that, the CCWG's made great strides at moving the reviews into the bylaws as well as the other commitments in paragraphs 3, 4, 7, and 8. And Sam, I think that's great. Other provisions that are deemed essential, mm-hmm. we'll add that.
Yeah.
Cheryl, we've been over this one many times. Don't think there's too much more needed.
I sincerely hope not, but speak now or forever hold your peace, people on this call. Well, hold your peace till we do a final run-through. Sounded a bit too autocratic even for me. Looks like it's sold, Steve. 15.
Okay, great. Okay, number 15. Team gets to the notion that if ICANN were to take actions to eliminate a legal presence in a place where users or registrants are seeking to hold ICANN accountable, it's almost treating a scenario where ICANN were deliberately trying to avoid legal jurisdiction in a particular place. We discussed paragraph 8 of the affirmation requires ICANN to remain headquartered in the U.S., but again, ICANN can terminate the affirmation at any time. And the measures that are proposed here is the community would have standing to veto a board decision if the board made a public decision to change its legal presence or to vacate a legal presence. Another provision was to bring into the bylaws potentially paragraph 8 in the affirmation of commitments and would require and maintain a legal presence. This became a hot topic at the U.S. Senate Commerce Committee hearing 3 weeks ago, the CEO of ICANN sort of unilaterally said, we're never going to change that requirement, which caught a lot of people off guard. And when he said it, there were a couple of senators that picked up on it and said, great, great, we're going to hold you to it. A lot of that's political theater, but it's out there now, and this is being discussed more openly. And then finally, if once affirmation of commitments were brought into the bylaws, if ICANN attempted to then amend those bylaws after the transition, there are measures in being considered to allow the community to block a bylaws change that would maybe undo what the CCWG was able to do. We'll take a cue on this one, Cheryl.
Yes, indeed, we have a cue. There's a comment, of course, from Sam. So did you want to speak to that, Sam?
No, I think it's the same issue we just discussed before.
Yep. There is no cue, Steve.
All right, 5 minutes to go with one left.
Woohoo!
I don't think we've discussed this one yet. So the idea here was subcontracting under a future agreement. James Bladel added this one when we were in Frankfurt. Remember that Cheryl was the last one
yep.
to come in?
That's right.
And Cheryl, you and I wrote to James to ask whether we had explained this properly.
Mm. We haven't heard to the contrary.
James, I don't think so, no. I think that James said we had it right.
Yep.
So at least we've captured what it was the author of the stress test had in mind. But James did write back, I've got it here, where he wants to add under the first column, under consequences, he would add, or no longer satisfies NTIA's principles for IANA transition. No longer satisfies the NTIA principles for the IANA transition. What James is talking about is the four principles that were in the transition are something we're all aware of now, but once the transition is over, those principles disappear. I think that's worth noting, but James said the rest of it was fine.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this was one of those stress tests, Cheryl, that speaks more to the CWG and ICG, because it has to do with the IANA functions,
yep.
not specifically within the CCWG. So we're not attempting to apply the stress test yet because we haven't seen what the CCWG proposal
has come up with. Yeah.
Yeah. So this is one of the four that we offer in a helpful way to the CWG and ICG.
But we do need to sanity check it, and this is where this reading, which is the first reading, is very important. So if you can all just take a couple of minutes to look and see, does it pass properly? Do you believe that what we're aiming at is going to be clearly understood when it's read, et cetera?
And I don't think James was getting at anything too sophisticated here. He was getting to the notion that as the contractor for the IANA namings function, ICANN might subcontract a piece of that to a third party. And could it do so without community approval? Or could it do so and then ignore the community's objection to that subcontracting? And currently under the IANA contract with NTIA has to give consent for outsourcing and subcontracting. Well, NTIA disappears. Who's the counterparty? We may or may not have an entity that's the counterparty to ICANN.
Mm.
Somebody may
yeah.
step into NTIA's shoes. And if that's the case, this highlights the need to be sure the community has something to say before ICANN were to subcontract or outsource. Pretty straightforward.
Hopefully straightforward enough that the lack of cue indicates that we can take that as a first reading, and then we can now take this list with the proposed modifications and edits coming in from a few of you. Steve, do you want a deadline on the language from Everhart and Sam? What's going to work for you on that?
I would so greatly appreciate having it by close of business Thursday. That's tomorrow. Close of business tomorrow. Whatever text you can get me, I'll put it in there. So Everhart, for instance, if I know you've got plenty of professional responsibilities, if you can't get it further, I'll just put in what you have and indicate that it's work in process. So by close of business Thursday.
Yep. Obviously, this doesn't close off. This is a living document. It's still got a lot of life in it, but it would be good to have version 8 out in good time for people to read before they travel, or while they're travelling perhaps, to Frankfurt. Everhart, I see your hand up. Go ahead.
What close of business are you talking about?
Yes, please talk in UTC, you nasty American news, Steve.
I will try and work today and tomorrow evening. I'm before, if I'm finished at midnight my time, that's about 2 hours behind. At the moment, it's 3 o'clock my time, that's 1 o'clock UTC. So if I'm finished at 10 o'clock in the evening, that would be 8 o'clock UTC. That gives Stephen enough time.
Sounds like a plan.
Yeah.
But if I'm not finished, I'll send you what I have.
That'll be fine.
That's absolutely perfect. Well, at the top of the hour, I think it's a great place to be, Steve.
And I have to run now.
Thank you very much, Everhart. Appreciate it.
Okay.
Bye-bye. So, Steve, I think we're in pretty good position now to look shortly after those texts coming in to have a version 8 out, and then having that as this stress test work party's contribution as a document for discussion at the Frankfurt meeting.
Okay, so the version 8 will go out on this Friday after I've received mm-hmm. any final edits. I'll send around a doc, a PDF, and a red line.
Right.
Against version 7, so people will see the changes that are made, okay?
Terrific.
All right, fantastic.
Did I say something other than Istanbul, Jonathan? I may very well have done. I think I may have done. I apologize. It's Istanbul, I think we're all going to, but anyway. Okay. Thank you very much, and thank you for putting up with my lack of presence at the beginning of the call. Unfortunately, the telecommunications was not... the gremlins weren't playing nicely, or perhaps they were playing nicely, just not letting me in. Thank you one and all, Steve. Thank you in particular, as ever. You're doing so much heavy lifting on that. But I think we're in a good position to now move to our discussions in Istanbul. Thank you, Jonathan. Thank you, one and all. And for those of you who are travelling, travel safe and look forward to seeing you face-to-face or on the Adobe Connect room. Bye for now. You can stop.